You know, and how the different discourses really portray or present different languages and different doorways into understanding what the Buddha really placed at the heart of this path, which is truly the liberation of the heart, the liberation of the mind, and the end of all distress and confusion and struggle. These discourses are not always easy to read. They're not always easy, particularly to read alone. But I want to run through this one, just recap it really from the beginning very, very briefly, where the Buddha's really responding to a question, you know, what is the source of conflict? You know, what is the source of distress and alienation and separation and argument, which we see actually so apparent in our world and often all too apparent in our own lives, and often feel almost disabled in our response of how to bring this to an end, even though deeply we long for and aspire to the end of conflict, you know, and the end of argument and the end of division and the end of separation, that somehow we don't always feel enabled to find the way to that end. So the point of these discourses and the point of these teachings really is to enable us to somehow internalize the understandings and the skills to actually meet the very same dilemmas that the Buddha met in his time and that his society met in his time. And what we see that some of the patterns of conflict and, you know, aversion is as timeless as the human mind, isn't it? I mean, this actually helps a little bit, I might say, you know. This is where we actually don't see, you know, somehow this is my fault or, you know, this is my issue to work on. This is almost as, if confusion is as timeless as, conflict is as timeless as confusion. You know? So the Buddha endeavors to provide us with sort of maps, roadmaps almost, you know, that we can trace and track and develop understanding and actually apply this to our own lives, because clearly this only makes a difference if somehow we live it, and we live it in the details, you know, not always in the big crises, you know, or, you know, the big events, but in the very small details of our life where we find, you know, the patterns of distress making operating. And, you know, that is, I think, so important, that we're not kind of, you know, just looking at the huge conflicts or, you know, the big world. We're actually looking at our world of the moment and how that world is fabricated and built in ways that create and recreate distress. But that is optional. That creation and recreation of distress is only made possible because the conditions for creating and recreating distress are in place. And what the Buddha is suggesting is those conditions that make the mind inclined towards building those worlds of argument and confusion, that those conditions are fluid, those conditions are approachable, those conditions are malleable. And that although they may feel very embedded, we always have the option of cultivating the conditions inwardly that incline the mind towards non-distress making and non-distress creating. And this is what the path is actually concerned with, you know, the cultivation of ethics, the cultivation of kindness and compassion and generosity, the cultivation of curiosity and investigation, you know, the cultivation of calm collectedness, the cultivation and the practice of insight. And I really stress that, the practice of insight is actually inclining the mind towards non-fabrication and non-distress building. So, you know, much of the Buddha's teaching, you know, I think why it often lands so easily often with people is because it's actually not telling us much that we don't already know. You know, that's interesting, isn't it? You know, it's actually not telling us things that we're in a big argument with. You know, we could make a long list of what we know, don't we? You know, we all know about impermanence. We all know about instability. We all know that grasping leads to contractedness. We all know the benefits of compassion and kindness. We all know the outcomes of distractedness and reactivity. You know, we all know the benefits of being willing to meet life as it is. I mean, none of this is news to any of us, is it? This is kind of like life experience. Our whole life has been teaching us those lessons, you know. And so what the Buddha is suggesting is that we really need to actually implement that knowing. We really need to move from a sort of conceptual knowing into an embodied living, you know, and this is actually what the path is really concerned with, you know, to make that movement. Not that we have, you know, of course, sometimes we learn new information, you know, such, we can, like this, we learn sometimes new concepts or new ways of framing this. But what we're doing is reframing things we actually already have glimpsed or known. And so the encouragement is always to move into this embodied living, this embodied way of being, where we live in the light of what we know, understanding that insight has implications. You know, if we really know about impermanence and change, it has big implications for our lives, for how we live. Because it kind of sort of makes a mockery of grasping, of clinging. You know, if we know that the source of genuine happiness and joy is inwardly generated and that is not going to be, you know, provided by getting and gaining and craving and becoming, then we need to actually develop that knowing into something that's unshakable. You know, knowing that inwardly generated happiness, knowing that inwardly generated joy, because this is what brings an end to craving. What brings an end to craving? If we actually know also that the sources of unhappiness, that although conditions can be very, very difficult in our lives, that the source of unhappiness are really in our response to those difficulties, it kind of also brings aversion to an end. So it's actually truly understanding the implications of our understanding and turning our knowing into an understanding that we live and living in the light of that, you know. So this is where we actually practice insight. So the Buddha began this discourse with, you know, really this question on the table almost, you know, why is there conflict, you know? Why is there war? Why is there violence? Why is there estrangement? You know, why is there alienation? And then he begins to explore that, you know, and really begins to recognize that as long as we're living in a world that is fabricated, that is built upon the basis almost of arguing with what we know, that as long as we're building a world of experience moment to moment based on distorted views, the rest is just going to follow, you know. The rest is just going to follow unless we question those distorted views. You know, there are going to be tendencies built upon them, reactive tendencies built upon them. There are going to be distorted perceptions. And there is going to be a world, thought-constructed world. And the outcome is actually going to be unhappiness. The outcome is going to create and recreate the sort of conditions for argument and for conflict and for contention. So the Buddha says the first thing we need to do is to understand this, you know, to understand how this comes into being. And this is not an inaccessible understanding for any of us, because any moment of distress, any moment of psychological, emotional reactivity is actually sending us a message. It's not sending us a message of judgment. It's sending us a message to actually look more deeply at where we're actually practicing the distortions rather than practicing the understandings. And actually what the Buddha is so pointing out in this discourse is that this is all process-oriented. This is all process-oriented. It's fluid, it's unfolding, it's dynamic. There is nothing predetermined in dukkha. And that just because something has a long history does not imply that it has an equally long future. Because what the Buddha is saying is that we keep bringing the past into the present. And by bringing the past into the present through association and distorted perceptions, we then bring the present into the future. You know? And, you know, there's that wonderful teaching where the Buddha says, you know, all that we are now is the outcome of all that we have been. And all that we have been, all that we will be in the next moment will be the outcome of all that we are now. So the Buddha is actually looking at, you know, how we are inclining the mind and how inclining the mind in certain ways, rooted in distortions, governed by underlying tendencies, is almost a sure way of guaranteeing that that is going to continue into the present and into the future. So the Buddha's first pointer is, well, let's look at how this world of distress, this world of argument is being built. Let's understand that. Let's track that. Let's trace that with curiosity, with investigation, with care, with mindfulness, beginning to slow down those processes, truly realizing that there's always a turning point possible. There's always a turning point possible where we're actually not in these loops of repeating over and over again patterns of distress making. So there's always a turning point, and the turning point begins with our curiosity, with our care, with our compassion, with our investigation, and with understanding actually that, you know, the world that we fabricate and construct, of course, is intersecting with other worlds that are being fabricated and constructed, you know, so that our patterns of distress making become collective patterns of distress making, you know, they become social patterns of distress making, they become global patterns of distress making, and we can learn to break out of that web and really care about the kind of footprint that we leave on the world and the kind of relationships we form and what we bring to them. And so those choice moments, those turning points, you know, really begin with mindfulness and with understanding, you know, really understanding this construction of our world. So what the Buddha is saying is that, you know, the construction of our world is also the construction of a self. Because a world construction is always interwoven with a self construction. You know, we don't have a fabricated world that is independent of a fabricated self, sense of self. And you know, we keep fabricating that world because from the perspective of a fabricated self, we're always making that world self-referential and what it means to me. You know, so then we live in that world that is good, bad, terrible, ugly, you know, right, wrong. And so he's talking about the co-arising of a fabricated sense of self and then a fabricated sense of world where we actually make a self within all things. You know, and the Buddha's actually pointing towards this. It's not, I wouldn't call it a process of deconstruction necessarily, but a process of questioning those fabrications. Because actually we see that actually we're moving a world we made up. A lot of the time. Not that we've imagined, but that we've made up its meaning through distortions. And so our responses become so limited, you know. Actually, our reactions become quite predictable because we've reified that world that has been fabricated, because we've reified the self world that has also been fabricated. The Buddha's talking about the cessation of this process of fabrication, and that does not imply in any way that it's not a nihilistic approach. It's not about, you know, getting rid of the world, erasing the world of experience. It's actually bringing an end to a world of fabricated experience that creates distress. So actually understanding the sort of constructed nature of self and understanding the constructed nature of the world that lives only in relationship to self, we actually cease to make selves in all things. And actually, rather than thinking of what this means to me, we actually really do begin to move from this question of what this means to me to a question of meaningfulness. Because when we're no longer locked in that position of self and other, you know, which is sometimes antagonistic, sometimes rooted in craving, but always constructed, we actually can actually begin to discover meaningfulness in how we are present in the world, that all things are meaningful just by being present and deserving of care. But it's not me actually responding. It, Nagarjuna, one of the great teachers of emptiness, you know, speaks of emptiness moving through emptiness, but fully embodied compassion and fully embodied responsiveness, but of emptiness moving through emptiness. You know, so the Buddhist learning actually teaching, I think, showing a roadmap of how to step out of these fabrications that feel so solid and so authoritative and that keep getting reinforced through the underlying tendencies of conceit and craving and aversion. So it's actually really an invitation actually to look at how we kind of step out of those cycles, how we step out of those cycles of repetition, how we learn not to be a prisoner of those underlying tendencies, how we begin to see that those underlying tendencies only have certainty and ground as long as the distortions are unquestioned. We actually learn to see the impermanent as impermanent. We actually learn to see the non-self in all things. We actually learn to see dukkha as something that can be met with compassion and courage, but that's not particularly, it's not my fault. We actually learn to meet vulnerabilities as just being a human being, deserving of care and compassion, without creating a self. So the Buddha takes us through all of these steps, which, you know, through my proliferation of papers, takes us through all of these steps that really can actually be tracked, you know, can be traced, you know, and begin to see the ways in which some of these are so implicated in this creation and recreation of struggle and distress and can be accessed and can be brought to an end. And this is really the heart of the Buddha's teaching. You know, he's not teaching just life skills or strategic responses, you know. I mean, this can all be good and useful, you know. But actually what the Buddha's talking about, coming to an unshakable liberation of the heart. And that's where he says the anusyas end without remainder. It's like they're not just on hold, you know. It's not just like they're kind of lying latent. He says the end without remainder when we come to actually the source of the anusyas, which actually are the distorted perceptions. This is not just meditative practice, you know. This is life practice. This is a life inquiry, you know. It's not just about time on a cushion or... But it does involve, and I hope really... If there's anything I wanted to encourage for this weekend is, you know, how helpful it is to engage with the teaching, how helpful it is to have an informed practice, you know, and to have a sense of direction in the practice and to have a sense of the territory that we're exploring. You know, I sometimes fear, you know, in Western practice, it gets kind of, I don't know, sort of presented as, you know, this... you know, mindful observation of what's going on. There's much more to this path than that. You know, the Buddha actually said that investigation is the most important factor of awakening. You know, and if we're going to investigate, sometimes the roadmaps are really helpful. You know, sometimes the frameworks and the templates are really helpful. But more than that, I think it's really inspiring. You know. I mean, that's what I love about reading the teachings, you know, and studying the teachings. It's a kind of sense of inspiration it brings, you know, not only about exploring what is, but exploring the possibilities that are being spoken about as being relevant to us, you know. And don't just think of awakening as something that happened 2,500 years ago to a few people, you know. I mean, this is actually the current present day message of these teachings is actually to wake up, you know, to learn to wake up, you know. So, you know, I really encourage you, you know, to continue that exploration of the teachings, you know, to find your roadmap. I mean, many of these roadmaps, you know, I just, you know, some of them are in the suttas and I'm always making up new maps. You know, that's become my new fetish almost. you know, is making new lists and making new maps. You know, it's kind of a bit embarrassing, but, you know, I think it comes from a long tradition, you know, so I'm really not too embarrassed, you know. But there's something about making up your own maps, you know, and making up your own lists, you know, that to help you to take something from the teachings and actually kind of translate them, you know, into your own life, you know, in your own experience, and to see, well, how does that work for me? You know, there's a creativity involved in this investigation. You know, it's not just about, you know, memorizing and learning. It's about exploring and actually really being able to ask, you know, what does this mean to me? You know, what does this look like in my own experience? You know, because if there isn't inspiration and joy in the practice, I'm not sure what there is. There's probably work. There's probably work. So it's really, you know, I always think, you know, when people tell me, you know, about, you know, the challenges they have in sustaining their practice, you know, the first question I always ask is, how much nourishment do you have? How much inspiration do you have? You know, what brings you to a cushion? What brings you to want to sort of turn towards the present moment and understand it? You know, and I think without that inspiration, it you know, practice too often becomes practice, you know, time on a cushion. It doesn't become a life filled with inquiry. You know? So I think sometimes to find the ways that nourish you, to find the ways that inspire you, and not to regard this huge body of teaching as something that's kind of, you know, outdated or inaccessible. I know many of the translations are sometimes, you know, a little challenging, to say the least. I used to use them, I have to confess this, you know, about 30 years ago when I couldn't sleep, I'd pick up a sutta. Sure, fight better than a sleeping pill. Knock you right out, you know. But mind you, my relationship to the teachings has so much changed since then. But what I've discovered is you need to do line by line reading, you know, because a line that you think is a kind of a toss away line, you know, like nothing there to delight in, welcome or cling to, that's a really big line. You know, that's a really, really big line. And what I've discovered is you have to really do line by line reading. And we're so blessed in our age, you know. People like Bhikkhu Bodhi have done such a... I mean, you should see the old translations. You know, you would just give up in a moment, you know. Bhikkhu Bodhi has done such a marvelous job in actually beginning to bring some of these translations to life. And, you know, I think there's a great value, personally. I think there's a huge value. You know, I find more and more I move towards actually working with the early texts as a sort of ground of my teaching, you know, because there's something there that is so timeless. It's actually so timeless in speaking to the human condition, you know, and the human quest, you know, the very human quest for aliveness and for awakening. And so if you can find ways, you know, to begin to sort of sidle up to the early teachings, I would really, really encourage it, you know. And there are ways, you know, we are blessed, I think, with the translations. And also, you know, there are a few good study courses around. Someone asked me earlier about readings. I'm part of a small group of people. We've started this thing called, this project, which I really can't believe I did, called Bodhi College. And it's really rooted in the study of the early texts. And if you go to bodhicollege.org, I actually think it has one of the best reading lists around. Bodhi, bodhicollege.org. And I think it actually does have one of the best reading lists around, and some of the things on that reading list, you know, you're not going to find on the bookshelves of your local store, you know, but some of them are online, and some of them you have to actually buy. But you know, there is something about this sort of comprehensiveness, I think, that is found in the teaching that's well worth looking into. We also offer a lot of study programs, but none in North America so far, although we are going to do something in conjunction with Tricycle as an online study program. I know that's one of the things I sign up for, you know. But anyway, there are resources available for you. BCBS, Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, I think has got some good study courses online now, and so does Gil Fronsdale. Has got some very credible and accessible study things online. So that's the end of the advertising, by the way. That's the end of the advertising. So, but just as a pointer to where you may access some resources, they are available, you know. And I think, you know, sometimes if you can get together with a friend or a group, you know, and actually go through a discourse, it's a lot easier. You know, this is a very oral tradition, you know. It's a very oral tradition, you know. So actually, you know, being able to read something out loud makes a huge difference, you know, rather than reading it silently. And actually, if you could read it together with others. Sorry.
And I was going to ask, does it matter where you start, or can you just dive in anywhere with the suttas?
There's a compilation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. There's a compilation of discourses. What's it called? The Blue Book.
Something of the Buddha's teachings.
The Words of the Buddha. Thank you. The Words of the Buddha. That's actually a really good place to start. That's a good place to start. There's some, you know, he's chosen a small selection of very, very, I think, very accessible discourses in there. That's a really good place to start.
Bhikkhu Bodhi also has a very old course that's available online, and so you can go to the suttas and he talks about them and gives evaluation. That's really helpful.
So Bhikkhu Bodhi does have a sort of something online also, but there are ways of accessing these things, you know. And so, you know, it's wonderful, I think, to bring them to life, because sometimes when you only read them, you know, and don't sort of translate them into what does this look like in my world today, you know, it can feel very dry, you know, kind of a bit dry and a bit sort of abstract. But I think like this one, you need to really translate it into what does this look like in the world today, you know, and in my own life. And then you get a sort of sense of, oh, yeah, the Buddha wasn't dated. You know, he wasn't never like a, you know, best before stamp on. You know, it's kind of pretty current stuff, you know. It's pretty current stuff. And actually, what I think is most important, it really speaks to a sense of possibility. You know, it doesn't speak to the difficulties of the human condition. It actually really speaks to the possibilities of the human heart and the human mind. And I think it's really important to take that quite personally. You know, it's actually not speaking about a spiritual elite, you know, or, you know, or a select group of people, you know, who are capable of comprehending all of this profundity. And he's actually speaking to actually the potential of the human heart and the human mind. And I think that's the most inspiring, you know, and the most inspiring part, I think, of much of the early teachings, you know. The Buddha so recognized that distress is not predetermined. You know, there is not predetermined, that there is an ending. And that is actually the flowering, almost, of the human heart and the human mind, you know, that sense of possibility. So, you know, again, I really encourage you to practice with this stuff, you know. You can take any of this stuff and turn it into a practice, you know, into a daily life, every moment practice, you know. We don't have to go that far to look for papancha, crying out loud. You know, it's like Christmas papancha's coming, you know. It's like, no, you know. Any moment now, you know, any moment now, here comes, you know, everything I need to practice with papancha, you know, to start to actually see that, you know, we have what we need, you know, that this is not something, you know, remote or abstract, that we actually have what we need, and we learn to practice with it. Actually learn to practice with it. And that's, you know, that is really, I don't have anything more to say. I'm sorry, I just run out here. Does anybody have any outstanding questions?